The balance of boldness. The balance of boldness can be hard, right? It can be hard to determine when is it right to be a bold type of person. I think most of us, even in our own minds, we're starting to kind of think of people like, this is a bold person. But really, it's not a trait. It's not a distinguishing trait that we would probably use to identify. I think if we went through the whole room and said, okay, we're going to pick one word that defines this person, I doubt very many of us would think of the word bold. Maybe that person has a big personality, but I wouldn't really call them bold, right? Bold is kind of that confidence, right? Almost that swagger, that so confident that you are right, that you're willing to put all on the line to determine that the other person is wrong. That can be one way to look at it. Paul was accused of being bold, right? In the world's outlook, boldness could be defined as a number of things. Sometimes you see in the sports world, right, a player is mean and they call him a bold player. Really, the guy's just kind of a jerk. And not really bold about anything. He just lets his emotions drive him. He lets his flesh get in the way. And he's not really bold. He's just kind of a mean player. The word that a lot of media would use to describe as a dirty player, right? Someone that just, they try to get those jabs in where they can. Well, November 19th, 2004 was an infamous night for boldness in NBA history. Many of you avid sports fans are thinking, what historic basketball takes place in November, right? Because around here, all y'all think the most historic basketball takes place in March, right? Yeah, that's how y'all think. But when I say the word, and then you may say, well, what kind of maybe historic basketball would even take place in 2004? Well, that wasn't even that long ago. But when I say the words malice in the palace, it just has a nice ring to it, right? Some of you basketball fans in here are going, yeah. Okay, malice in the palace. You basketball fans might realize what I'm saying. For the rest of you, and let me just say, by the way, this is awesome. Brother Schmidt came up to me just a couple weeks ago, before they left for Brazil and such, and he was like, man, when you come into the office and talk about sports, he's like, I used to just think, why does he always talk about sports? But then he's like, it's actually helped me connect with some of the teens in the youth group. So sports saves lives, kids. Don't forget about that. So there. And maybe you can take, even if you aren't interested in sports at all, I'm giving you valuable cultural information that maybe you can use to reach the lost people in your workplace. We're working together as a team, people. So anyway, just take this, write it down, notes if you need to. It's important. It's important sports history here, all right? For the rest of you that may not know what the malice in the palace is, let me explain. The Palace of Auburn Hills is the name of the former basketball arena the Detroit Pistons played in Auburn Hills, Michigan. This game that happened to take place on November 19th, 2004, was against the Indiana Pacers. However, the Pistons were down on their home court. They were down 97-82, all right? So that's a pretty big spread with only 46 seconds to go. There's never been a comeback that large in that short of a time span in NBA history. So needless to say, in layman's terms, the game was over. Yes, they had to play out the final 46 seconds, but the game was basically over. Yet, the infamous Ron Artest, when Ben Wallace went up to shoot a layup, or went up to do a layup, just an easy basket, Ron Artest, being the infamous bully basketball player that he is, fouled him pretty hard. It was an obvious foul. He was given a technical for it. Well, of course, Ben Wallace was kind of furious. The game's over. Why get fouled? So he shoves Artest. There's a little bit of a kind of a scuttle back and forth. A couple players get involved. The refs are able to kind of disband him, and you'd think that's where it ends. Yet, Ron Artest, in his disgust, went to the score table and laid down on it and kind of started whining and complaining. Oh, man, always pushing me around. Yeah, I never get any respect. Well, a fan in the stands thought it would be wise to take his alcoholic beverage in its metal container, pretty full, and chuck it at Ron Artest. Sad to say, he hit his target pretty square on. As most of us would be, that would kind of upset us, right? If we got a full beverage chucked in our face. And it's alcoholic. We can't even drink it, for crying out loud. Anyway, So he gets up and charges the stands, like charges the where the fans are. And he and this fan get into a scuttle. He and his fan, this fan get involved. And what resulted was a 15-minute entanglement of players, fans, media, coaches, and refs. The end result was that the NBA suspended 9 players for a total of 146 games because of the fight. Over $11 million in salary was lost by those suspensions. 5 players were actually charged with assault, gaining themselves a year probation and many, many hours of community service. 5 fans also faced legal allegations, as well as being banned from the arena and any Detroit Pistons game in the future for life. Saddest, though, probably became the legacy of Ron Artest. Ron Artest was a small forward. He was kind of considered an up-and-coming small forward. He was a very talented player, but he let his emotions get the best of him. Ever since then, his legacy was kind of tainted. He was suspended for a long time. He ended up getting traded a lot. He actually played for 6 NBA teams before eventually trying his luck in the China Basketball League. Played for 2 teams before he was released then and tried to come back into the NBA, but was only picked up as a substitute. Even legally changed his name to Meta World Peace. Not joking. He went from Ron Artest, legally changed his name to Meta World Peace, as if somehow people would look at his name and think, oh, he's changed. He's not that mean player he used to be. Yet everyone considered him an emotional player who would soon elbow a dude in the face as soon as he got in the flesh, an act he did actually commit many times. It's safe to say that Ron Artest... Well, yes, because he did change his name back. I mean, wouldn't you? He didn't have a grip on his emotions. He didn't have a grip on it. If you wanted to attribute the title bold into that story, frankly, he lost control on his boldness. He wanted so desperately to be bold and to be affronting and to be that guy that, man, he knew if he was right and he'd get involved. But sadly, his actions stripped away anything that had to do with his ability to communicate, his ability to be a good teammate. I mean, if you do anything that suspends you for basically the rest of the season and you're a talented player, your team's going to suffer because of it. In the moment, he wasn't thinking about that. He wasn't thinking about how he'd falsely represent the team or even the NBA. That's why these big corporations, the NBA, the NFL, part of their mandate is that you behave not just because they want you to look good, but because you are representing them as an organization. You are the face of their league. That's why they came down so harshly on him. So we have also throughout history, though, athletic figures as well as just figures around in the real historic world that have executed boldness. Just even in the sports world, we think of someone like Michael Jordan, right? We think of this guy who was a tremendous basketball player who everyone said he was the nastiest like trash talker you'd ever see on the court. Like, he wouldn't let it be loud enough for the media to hear, but players would walk away saying, man, he gets in your head. He gets in your head. He's bold, but he never let his emotions get the best of him. He was never a dirty fouler. He never messed up the integrity of the game. We think of even world leaders, right? Like what was one of the biggest distinguishing principles of Winston Churchill, right? Is that he wouldn't back down. He was the British bulldog, right? He was the guy that was bold. He would stand bold even if his armies were in pretty inferior to those he was facing against. He was bold in his approach. So we see throughout history that boldness can be effective, but it has to be balanced. If it's not, we get to the level of meta world peace. We get to the level of someone who becomes unhinged and, frankly, ineffective. What we have here in our text is a pretty harsh accusation of Paul. They're actually accusing Paul of that very same thing. Paul, you're at the level of boldness that you're becoming a little unhinged. When you're with us, you're nice and peachy, you're meek, you're gentle. But man, then you write these letters to us and you get on us. You're harsh towards us. It makes sense. We've all read Paul's writings, right? We understand that Paul can get very down to earth, very down to point. I love Paul's writing. The rest of the Bible is very narrative. It's a very story narrative. And there's nothing, but that's how it's written. That's how God chose to give it to us. And what I mean by that is the Bible will tell a story. It'll tell a narrative about how God works in a specific area. And then we use that story to apply how then God will fulfill his promises or work in our lives. And we see how that's played out in much of the Old Testament and in much of the New Testament. But Paul's writings are not in narrative form. Paul very rarely uses parables. Paul very rarely explains anything other than just straight doctrine, straight understanding. Hey, you, believer, this is how you should live. This is right, this is wrong. We find in the book of Romans is filled with doctrinal truths on salvation, on Christology, on who Jesus is. It's rich with it. We find throughout his prison epistles, we just find like a beautiful spirit of a man who's just encouraging churches to live faithfully. And we see doctrine rich on the church and how the church should function and how the church should develop and how the church should grow and should expand and reach others with the gospel. It's very down to earth. There's sometimes little or no interpretation to how we should apply what Paul is beseeching the churches and by extension us to do. Here are some examples. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly. Is there any misinterpretation as to what that could possibly mean? Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly. Be not entangled again with the yoke of bondage. If a man be overtaken in a fault, ye which are spiritual, restore. Let him that stole steal no more. I love that one. It's just right out there, right in front of you. Let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth. How about children, obey your parents in the Lord? Okay, we got one. Good job. A lot of Paul's writings are just pretty straightforward. Hey, here's what you as a believer need to do. Paul's writings are pretty bold. What Paul is writing here to the Corinthians and even in the rest of his writings and even applied to us, they're pretty bold. A lot of his writings you read and they are declarations. Believer, do this. That's bold. If I walked up to you and said, hey, you, do this, that's a bold thing. And we're taught, you know, very culturistically, just kind of, you know, in our genuine sweet society, right? Hey, brother, would you please do this for me? That'd be a huge blessing. But if I came up and was like, do this, do it now, please. Now. Nope, not then, now. That'd be bold. Almost kind of rude, right? You'd be like, all right, Brother Harold, we get it. You're being bold. Stop it. Cut it out. But Paul's writings are pretty bold. And that's exactly what the church in Corinth is accusing him of being. Which, can I say, Paul kind of has every right to be. Because if you study through the two letters to the church in Corinth, you'll find that Paul has a very good reason to be bold in what he's telling them. It's fairly simple to understand that this infamous church in Corinth is quite well known for their struggles. Paul wrote two very large letters overly condemning such acts, including a man living in fornication with his stepmom, the church overlooking public sin in the congregation, leaders involved in unjust practices, the church inviting false teachers to minister to the congregation, a group of men undermining Paul and hoping to get his authority over the church overthrown, the church desiring to establish leaders without Paul's knowledge, not caring for their widows and elderly, the misuse of money. I could go on and on. If you read the book of 1 Corinthians, so much of it is Paul saying, you're doing this, stop it. Like, cut it out. This is not the way a church should live. This is not a way a church should minister. This is detrimental to the gospel. And Paul is very comforting, and he says it in love, and he's saying it so that they can get on the right track. And I think that's important. He's not writing these letters to just slam the church in Corinth and say, you are of no use to us, be no longer. No, it's meant for edifying. It's meant for growth. He's trying to minister to this church so that they can get back on the right track. There's a purpose for it. So then, in between these two letters, there are people in the church that got pretty upset. Man, you remember when Paul was here? You remember when Paul, like, really established this church? You remember how nice Paul was? when he told us about Jesus. And man, we'd sometimes mess up. And he's like, hey, that's not how Christians should behave. We need to make sure we're doing things this way. And we'd get discipled, and he was just so meek and so gentle and just kind of uplifting us in the Lord. And they were like, and then he writes this nasty, mean, accusing letter. The audacity of Paul. How dare he? Those were the accusations that Paul was getting. Your boldness, Paul, is unwelcome. Don't want you to be bold. Be nice, meek, gentle, Paul, that we all knew before. The Paul that you're too scared to be bold in front of us, Paul. When you're here, you're meek, you're gentle. You're scared to be bold when you're here. But then you're far away, right? And you write a letter and you get all tough. Oh, we've accused people of that on the internet, right? Oh, you're hiding behind your texts. You'll text somebody something mean, but you wouldn't dare say it to their face. This is what they're accusing Paul of doing, the apostle, who, failure for them to understand, is actually under inspiration of the Holy Spirit to write this for us to use today. So obviously we know who is in the wrong in this story. Yet we find Paul with not just a simple, but a seasoned response. He opens up in that first verse in our text. Now I, Paul, myself, beseech you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ. I love how he opens that up. Can I tell you that that's almost a slap in the face to the accusations they're giving him? Because he's straight up admitting, yeah, I'm meek and gentle, and I beseech you. Because remember, this whole second letter wasn't just a response to their accusations against him. There was other junk going on in the church he had to deal with first. But now that we're in the final couple chapters of this letter, Paul's actually finding need to defend himself. Not to defend himself so that he looks good, but so that they understand the authority that he has in relative relation to the gospel and how they should then work on their church. Because if they strip him of his authority, then all he says they can discredit as not really important. Thus, the church is going to continue to go on its wrong direction. But Paul's needing to defend his authority so that they understand what is truth and that they understand that this is from the Lord, not just some angry guy that's writing a letter, and that they can get their church on the right path. Now I, Paul, myself beseech you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ. First thing, right here in front. The meekness and gentleness that we as believers are supposed to declare unto one another, the ones that we're supposed to actually reach the world with, that gentleness and meekness, that example comes from no one else than Jesus himself. And that's what Paul is explaining here. Who in presence and base among you, but being absent and bold towards you. Again, he's just admitting everything they're saying, right? He just said it. He said, who in presence, so when I'm before you, and base among you, bottom, I'm lowest among you, but being absent and bold towards you. He's basically stating, yeah, what you're saying is true. When I'm away and I'm writing this letter, when I'm far from you, I am being bold towards you. But I beseech you that I may not be bold when I am present with that confidence, wherewith I think to be bold against some, which think of us as if we walked according to the flesh. So we see here initially some of the reasons that he's writing this letter. Some of the reasons is he's calling out those who are accusing him of being bold in the flesh, right? And that would be understandable. Sometimes we can appear bold, but really we're just angry because our flesh has been stirred, right? And that's what they're accusing Paul of doing here. And Paul's very quickly is ironing out the idea that he is bold, that he is writing this letter out of anger. He distinguishes that thought. Not writing this because some of you are accusing me, I'm writing this in the flesh, I'm writing this because I'm angry. He's extinguishing that thought, saying, nope, that's not the reason I'm writing this. Verse 3, for though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds. Winky face. I don't know if you see it in your Bible. My Bible has a little winky face there. I choose to think that Paul legitimately winked there. I'm just kidding. All right. total. May have just thrown off the entire message tonight. No, anyway. So we see tonight in Paul's writings here that he's explaining that the battle is not a physical battle. This idea that Paul, you're bold against us. You're attacking us, you're wanting to hurt us, you're being bold, it's unwelcome, we don't want it. What he's reminding them is the battle that they think he has with them isn't against them. It's not a physical battle. What Paul's explaining is he's fighting a spiritual battle. He's fighting for the life of a church. He's fighting for the life of the souls that that church can reach. He's fighting a spiritual battle, which is so much more important than a physical battle. Again, Christian, can I remind you that our enemy are not the people of the world. Never once in the Bible is our enemy described as people of the world. It's described as three things: our own flesh, the devil, and the culture of the world itself. The idea of the world and the laws that it would try to attack Christianity with. That's what our enemies would be. But our enemy is not the people of the world. It's the sin. That's why we at Knollwood hold to a very fundamental truth that, frankly, there are churches in this same town that don't understand. That we don't hate people. We hate their sin. We hate the sin that engulfs them. We hate the sin that traps them and deceives them. We hate the sin that leads them away from God. We hate the sin that would lead them down to a path towards hell. That's what we hate. And that's why, frankly, we're a church that promotes soul winning. We're a church that promotes proclaiming the gospel. That's why we're a church that promotes a VBS where we get to teach kids about Jesus. That's why we promote a Sunday school where we can build a class that is around people's life stage so that they can plug in and feel welcome and feel like they're around people that know some of the stuff they're going through. Again, can I just briefly remind you that that's how our Sunday school's program is structured? It's not for you. It's actually for the guest. It's so the guest can plug in and see, hey, there are people around me that are going through some of the same things I'm going through, and they can feel more welcome. Then we can show them through really just that comfort, we can show them and declare to them the gospel. That's how Pastor has visioned our Sunday school class ministry to grow and to expand, that then we would help serve those that would come into our church, and we can proclaim the gospel of Jesus to them. Paul's reminding the church in Corinth, hey, I love you. I'm not attacking you. I don't hate you. I'm bold because of the sin. I'm bold because I'm fighting something much harsher than just a physical battle. I'm fighting a spiritual battle. Gives reason for his boldness. Verse 4, for the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds. He reminds them who equips us for that spiritual battle. Paul said, my boldness doesn't come from my own strength. Because I'm fighting a spiritual battle, not a physical battle, my tools that I use for this victory come through the Lord and through the Lord alone. This is Paul's explanation here. Verse 5, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. And this is the reason, and this is the battle that Paul is describing here. What is the purpose of the battle? To cast down imaginations and every high thing. To basically, can I summarize it this way? To put down anything that would dare hope to maximize itself up to or even surpassing the level of God. Now, we understand that nothing can actually surpass the level of God, but can I tell you that in your own hearts, there are certainly things that can. We put things in our own lives that we put priority over. We place something over, you know, I was going to get to my Bible reading today, but man, I was just tired. Can I say very plainly, you're putting your tiredness, your sleep over the things of God. That's simple. What Paul is describing here is a church that has had in their mind system for way too long that there are things that are more important than the things of God. Things like money. And again, we don't have time to go through the entirety of the two books, the two letters that Paul wrote to the church in Corinth. But we read chapter after chapter of basically proofs that this is a church that put their own pleasure, that put money, that put power, that put their own, how they were viewed in the eyes of people, their own, how they were viewed by the people, they put that as more important than the things of God, than simply reaching people. And Paul's describing in this very moment, that is why I'm bold. When he was there establishing the church, they were growing. They were trying to please the Lord. They were walking in truth. And even if they slipped up along the way, it was just part of a process where Paul was encouraging them and edifying them to continue moving towards their relationship with the Lord. And I think that's where Paul is trying to distinguish this difference. He's not denying it. He says, yeah, you're absolutely right. When I was with you, I was gentle, I was meek, and now I'm bold. But I think what he's also showing us is that those aren't mutually exclusive. That we can be gentle, meek people who are also bold about the things that matter. And I think where we lose people, I think where we lose our effectiveness is when we're bold about the things that don't matter. And we're kind of quiet and gentle and meek about the things that do. And I think if we're not careful, we'll mix those up. When we become a church that we care so much about how many people we can fit in these doors. We care about numbers. We care not for the sake of more people to reach, but because we want that appearance of being a church that has a lot of people inside of it that is so jam-packed. I don't see that. I don't see that as a desire our church has. I think we want more people in here, but again, I think our motives are pure. I think we want more people in here so that we can reach more people with Jesus. But can I tell you that's a very thing that happens to a lot of churches in this country, that they care more about how many people they can get and man, how many people listen to our sermons because we want other pastors to listen to our sermons and think that we have good preaching here. And man, we care about how big this is so that we look better in the churches that are around us. And man, we care so much about things that don't really matter. And man, we will get on a spitting fest with just the angriest and meanest of intentions with people on Facebook about no this political thing and no this standard issue, when really we aren't called to be bold about those things. And can I tell you, we'll lose our effectiveness and our testimony over it if we're not careful. I see people, just vulgar on social media, and I'll see people just getting heated arguments over things that are so stupid. Yet when it comes to if people are living right for Jesus or not, oh, I'm not going to talk to them about that. That's between them and the Lord. Paul set up a very clear, very simple way for us to follow. He says, yeah, there are times to be gentle. There are times to be meek. There are times where it would really be ineffective to not be. But can I tell you that there are times where it's appropriate to be bold? Can I tell you, very simply, it's when we're dealing with sin. When we as a church deal with sin, we're meant to be bold about it and make no apologies for it. Can I tell you, it's awkward. I have members in my family that it's awkward to talk to about certain, even social, political issues, because frankly, they've expanded it way past the idea of is it or is it not sin. You know, we can look at plainly biblically and say, actually, it comes down to it is sin. Thus, we have no part of it. Issues like abortion, issues like homosexuality. Can I tell you, I think those are the issues that we're to be bold about. Our pastors explained it from the pulpit, issues like human trafficking. Those are issues I think the church is meant to be bold about. My first year on Glory Bound, we had opportunity to travel to the southeast of the country and we were at this little church down in Kentucky. And this little church in Kentucky, we were talking with the pastor, and I don't remember how the conversation turned, but we found out that the county that the church was in was initially one of two remaining dry counties in the U.S. What I mean by that is it was illegal to sell alcohol in that county. The stores could not get a liquor license to sell any type of alcohol in that city, which is a pretty neat thing, right? Like, imagine if there was nowhere in Topeka that ever sold alcohol, because it'd be illegal. I'm sure people would do it out of their own house, just like they did in the Prohibition, but imagine that. And so, but he kind of became soft-spoken, because as the conversation turned, we realized that eventually that county is now, I guess, a wet county. It's not a dry county anymore. They're allowed to sell alcohol. And he told us that there was one time in 1997 where he and three other pastors from the area, there was a city council meeting where they were going to vote on if that county, or a county meeting, whatever, they were going to vote on whether that county would remain a dry county. And these preachers banded together and they came in and they put forward evidence and they did all these things. And the county seat was like, all right, we will remain a dry county. And that persuaded his vote. So the pastor said the same thing happened just a few, it was 2008 that it was up for being voted on again. There was some kind of, it had to be off the ballot for a certain number of years before it could be put through the county senate, and then it'd be brought into, you know, this ability to be voted on again. And it was before the county seat again, and the pastor of this church that we were at had received a call from another pastor and basically said, hey man, there's no way that this isn't going through. Just said, you know, the county wants it. Everyone in this town drinks already. They're tired of going three towns down to buy alcohol. Well, just, I think it's a losing battle. And so the pastors decided not to go fight it. And he's sitting there almost weeping, telling us that the day after the vote, the county seat voted, and sure enough, it was not a dry county anymore, that he got a call from the head chair. And they said, you know, all night we were waiting for you preachers to burst in just so we would have an excuse to keep this a dry county. And they basically said, we want to keep this a dry county. And they listed many reasons why. And they're like, we were just waiting for you and your other pastors to come in here and to give us that same evidence you did 10, 15 years ago, and we would have made this a dry county again. But when you weren't there, we had no choice but to give the people what they wanted, and we made it a wet county. And he sat there and he said, guys, I can't stress this enough. Even if it looks hopeless, fight the fight. Be bold. He said, we lost our opportunity to keep this county dry. And that may seem like a little thing, but it's not when you're dealing with families with a father who's alcoholic and abusive towards his children. It's not a light issue then. And we see that this pastor had faced a really sad story about where he wasn't bold on something that really mattered. And frankly, we can get in the flesh, just like they accused Paul of. Paul wasn't. But man, we can get in the flesh, and we can get so bold over things that frankly don't matter. Frankly, they'll lose our testimony. Yet when we face these issues that deal with sin, when we're looking our loved one in the eye, and not in a judging way, remember, what was Paul's motive here? It wasn't to berate them. It wasn't to hurt them. It wasn't to lower them down to a point where they could never, ever succeed. No, it was to get them back on the right track. And we'll look a loved one in the eye that just, they need that loving boldness from us to tell them, hey, this is wrong. We need to get back on the right track here. And we choose not to fight the fight. We choose to be meek in that moment when really it's just, frankly, cowardice. And I've been there. There's been conversations I should have had with family members, conversations I should have had with loved ones, with friends that I didn't have. And I saw some choices they made down the road that made me think, could I have prevented that? Could God have used me in a place to where maybe they wouldn't have made that decision down the road? And frankly, I don't know. But I know that there are times to be bold. And those times that Paul's outlined for us is when dealing with sin. That's why I got up here Sunday night and preach so heavily on the cross and how it should be our focus. Why? Because if it's not, and can I tell you, Christian, we have a heart problem. That's a problem of sin, and it's to be dealt with. That's why our pastor, those last few Sunday mornings he was here, was so heavily encouraging our congregation to put God first in so many ways, to stop living for ourselves, to stop trying to chase and pursue after our own pleasures, and just pursue after God. Why? Because to not is sin, and that's to be dealt with boldly. We see that Paul understands that this is something that is meant to edify and encourage. It's meant to get back on the right track. So then, we either have one of two places where we are. We're either the one that needs to be bold, or we're the one that's supposed to be the recipient of that boldness. Can I tell you, if you're the one that's meant to be bold, I'm not giving you a license to just start calling up all your friends that have problems, start ripping into their sin life. No, because then again, I think we're missing the motive. It's not so that we can feel better than they are. It's so that we can help them get on the right track. And frankly, I think Paul does it in a very real and very right way. It's not about him being better than they are. It's about him helping them chase and pursue after God. And I think if that's our motive in our hearts, I think if that's the reason, we shouldn't really have anything to worry about. We can pursue God. We can make sure it's the right move to make. And we can be bold. Be meek when it's time to be meek. Be bold when it's time to be bold. It's a balance. It's not always easy. When is it? When is living the Christian life easy? Man, if it was as easy as it sounds, man, we'd be perfect Christians, wouldn't we? Sadly, there's no such thing. And those of you that are much, much older than I am have story after story of times where, man, God worked on me. I thought I was doing pretty good, and I messed up, and God worked on me. I'm only 27 years old, and I already have those stupid stories where I'm like, man, I'm doing pretty good. I feel like I'm doing pretty good in the Lord. Man, the Lord wipes me down a couple steps, takes me down a couple rungs on the ladders, reminds me very quickly, you got a pretty big head. No, you're not there yet. But it's a process, the balance of bold.